options in the future. As the diversity of metaphors has been added to ethnic diversity and gender dualism to create new workstations in the postmodernist academic industry, and then politicized, schools and ideologies have multiplied explosively. Usually leftist in orientation, the more familiar modes of general postmodernist thought include Afrocentrism, constructivist social anthropology, critical, that is, socialist science, deep ecology, ecofeminism, Lacanian psychoanalysis, Latourian sociology of science, and neo-Marxism. To which, add all the bewildering varieties of deconstruction techniques and New Age holism swirling round about and through them. Their adherents fret upon the field of play, sometimes brilliantly, usually not, jargon-prone, and elusive. Each in his own way seems to be drifting toward that mysterium tremendum abandoned in the 17th century by the Enlightenment, and not without the expression of considerable personal anguish. Of the late Michel Foucault, the great interpreter of political power in the history of ideas, poised at the summit of Western intellectual life, George Shalaba has perceptively written, "Foucault was grappling with the deepest, most intractable dilemmas of modern identity. For those who believe that neither God, nor natural law, nor transcendent reason exists, and who recognize the varied and subtle ways in which material interest, power, has corrupted, even constituted, every previous morality, how is one to live? To what values can one hold fast? How and what indeed? To solve these disturbing problems, let us begin by simply walking away from Foucault and existentialist despair. Consider this rule of thumb. To the extent that philosophical positions both confuse and close doors to further inquiry, they are likely to be wrong. To Foucault, I would say, if I could, and without meaning to sound patronizing, it's not so bad. Once we get over the shock of discovering that the universe was not made with us in mind, all the meaning the brain can master, and all the emotions it can bear, and all the shared adventure we might wish to enjoy, can be found by deciphering the hereditary orderliness that has borne our species through geological time and stamped it with the residues of deep history. Reason will be advanced to new levels and emotions played in potentially infinite patterns. The true will be sorted from the false, and we will understand one another very well, the more quickly, because we are all of the same species and possess biologically similar brains." And to others, concerned about the growing dissolution and irrelevance of the intelligentsia, which is indeed alarming, I suggest there have always been two kinds of original thinkers: those who upon viewing disorder try to create order, and those who upon encountering order try to protest it by creating disorder. The tension between the two is what drives learning forward. It lifts us upward through a zigzagging trajectory of progress, and in the Darwinian contest of ideas, order always wins, because, simply, that is the way the real world works. Nevertheless, here is a salute to the postmodernists. As today's celebrants of Corybantic Romanticism, they enrich culture. They say to the rest of us, maybe, just maybe, you are wrong. Their ideas are like sparks from firework explosions that travel away in all directions, devoid of following energy, soon to wink out in the dimensionless dark. Yet a few will endure long enough to cast light on unexpected subjects. That is one reason to think well of postmodernism, even as it menaces rational thought. Another is the relief it affords those who have chosen not to encumber themselves with a scientific education. Another is the small industry it has created within philosophy and literary studies. Still another, the one that counts the most, is the unyielding critique of traditional scholarship it provides. We will always need postmodernists, or their rebellious equivalents. For what better way to strengthen organized knowledge than continually to defend it from hostile forces? John Stuart Mill correctly noted that teacher and learner alike fall asleep at their posts when there is no enemy in the field. And if somehow, against all the evidence, against all reason, the linchpin falls out and everything is reduced to epistemological confusion, we will find the courage to admit that the postmodernists were right, and in the best spirit of the Enlightenment, we will start over again. Because, as the great mathematician David Hilbert once said, capturing so well that part of the human spirit expressed through the Enlightenment, wir müssen wissen, wir werden wissen. We must know, we will know. Chapter 4. The Natural Sciences. By any reasonable measure of achievement, the faith of the Enlightenment thinkers in science was justified. Today, the greatest divide within humanity is not between races or religions, or even, as widely believed, between the literate and illiterate. It is the chasm that separates scientific from pre-scientific cultures. Without the instruments and accumulated knowledge of the natural sciences, physics, chemistry, and biology, humans are trapped in a cognitive prison. They are like intelligent fish born in a deep, shadowed pool, wondering and restless, longing to reach out. They think about the world outside. They invent ingenious speculations and myths about the origin of the confining waters, of the sun and the sky and the stars above, and the meaning of their own existence. But they are wrong, always wrong, because the world is too remote from ordinary experience to be merely imagined. Science is neither a philosophy nor a belief system. It is a combination of mental operations that has become increasingly the habit of educated peoples, a culture of illuminations hit upon by a fortunate turn of history that yielded the most effective way of learning about the real world ever conceived. With instrumental science, humanity has escaped confinement and prodigiously extended its grasp of physical reality. Once we were nearly blind, now we can see. Literally. Visible light, we have learned, is not the sole illuminating energy of the universe, as pre-scientific common sense decreed. It is instead an infinitesimal sliver of electromagnetic radiation, comprising wavelengths of 400 to 700 nanometers, billionths of a meter, within a spectrum that ranges from gamma waves trillions of times shorter to radio waves trillions of times longer. Radiation over most of this span, in wildly varying amounts, continually rains down on our bodies. But without instruments, we were oblivious to its existence. Because the human retina is rigged to report only 400 to 700 nanometers, the unaided brain concludes that only visible light exists. Many kinds of animals know better. They live in a different visual world, oblivious to part of the human visible spectrum, sensitive to some wavelengths outside it. Below 400 nanometers, butterflies find flowers and pinpoint pollen and nectar sources by the pattern of ultraviolet rays reflected off the petals. Where we see a plain yellow or white blossom, they see spots and concentric circles in light and dark. The patterns have evolved in plants to guide insect pollinators to the anthers and nectar pools. With the aid of appropriate instruments, we can now view the world with butterfly eyes. Scientists have entered the visual world of animals and beyond because they understand the electromagnetic spectrum. They can translate any wavelength into visible light and audible sound and generate most of the spectrum from diverse energy sources. By manipulating selected segments of the electromagnetic spectrum, they peer downward to the trajectories of subatomic particles and outward to star birth in distant galaxies whose incoming light dates back to near the beginning of the universe. They, more accurately we, since scientific knowledge is universally available, can visualize matter across 37 orders of magnitude. The largest galactic cluster is larger than the smallest known particle by a factor of the number one with about 37 zeros following it. I mean no disrespect when I say that pre-scientific people, regardless of their innate genius, could never guess the nature of physical reality beyond the tiny sphere attainable by unaided common sense. Nothing else ever worked, no exercise from myth, revelation, art, trance, or any other conceivable means, and notwithstanding the emotional satisfaction it gives, mysticism, the strongest pre-scientific probe into the unknown, has yielded zero. No shaman spell or fast upon a sacred mountain can summon the electromagnetic spectrum. Prophets of the great religions were kept unaware of its existence, not because of a secretive god, but because they lacked the hard-won knowledge of physics. Is this a paean to the god of science? No, to human ingenuity, to the capacity in all of us, freed at last in the modern era, and to the fortunate comprehensibility of the universe. The signature achievement of humanity has been to find its way without assistance through a world that proved surprisingly well-ordered. All our other senses have been expanded by science. Once we were deaf, now we can hear everything. The human auditory range is 20 to 20,000 hertz, or cycles of air compression per second. Above that range, flying bats broadcast ultrasonic pulses into the night air and listen for echoes to locate moths and other insects on the wing. Many of their potential prey listen with ears tuned to the same frequencies as the bats. When they hear the telltale pulses, they dip and wheel in evasive maneuvers, or else power dive to the ground. Before the 1950s, zoologists were unaware of this nocturnal contest. Now, with receivers, transformers, and nighttime photography, they can follow every squeak and aerial rollout. We have even uncovered basic senses entirely outside the human repertory. Where humans detect electricity only indirectly by a tingling of skin or flash of light, the electric fishes of Africa and South America, a medley of freshwater eels, catfish, and elephant-nose fishes, live in a galvanic world. They generate charged fields around their bodies with trunk muscle tissue that has been modified by evolution into organic batteries. The power is controlled by a neural switch. Each time the switch turns on the field, individual fish sense the resulting power with electroreceptors distributed over their bodies. Perturbations caused by nearby objects, which cast electric shadows over the receptors, allow them to judge size, shape, and movement. Thus, continuously informed, the fish glide smoothly past obstacles in dark water, escape from enemies, and target prey. They also communicate with one another by means of coded electrical bursts. Zoologists, using generators and detectors, can join the conversation. They are able to talk as through a fish's skin. From these and countless other examples can be drawn an informal rule of biological evolution important to the understanding of the human condition. If an organic sensor can be imagined that picks up any signal from the environment, there exists a species somewhere that possesses it. The bountiful powers of life expressed in such diversity raise a question about the incapacity of the unaided human senses. Why can't our species, the supposed summum bonum of creation, do as much as all the animals combined and more? Why were we brought into the world physically handicapped? Evolutionary biology offers a simple answer. Natural selection, defined as the differential survival and reproduction of different genetic forms, prepares organisms only for necessities. Biological capacity evolves until it maximizes the fitness of organisms for the niches they fill, and not a squiggle more. Every species, every kind of butterfly, bat, fish, and primate, including Homo sapiens, occupies a distinctive niche. It follows that each species lives in its own sensory world. In shaping that world, natural selection is guided solely by the conditions of past history and by events occurring moment to moment, then and now. Because moths are too small and indigestible to be energetically efficient food for large primates, Homo sapiens never evolved echolocation to catch them. And since we do not live in dark water, an electrical sense was never an option for our species. Natural selection, in short, does not anticipate future needs. But this principle, while explaining so much so well, presents a difficulty. If the principle is universally true, how did natural selection prepare the mind for civilization before civilization existed? That is the great mystery of human evolution, how to account for calculus and Mozart. Later, I will attempt an answer by expanding the evolutionary explanation to embrace culture and technological innovation. For the moment, let me soften the problem somewhat by addressing the peculiar nature of the natural sciences as a product of history. Three preconditions, three strokes of luck in the evolutionary arena, led to the scientific revolution. The first was the boundless curiosity and creative drive of the best minds. The second was the inborn power to abstract the essential qualities of the universe. This ability was possessed by our Neolithic ancestors, but, again, here the primary puzzle, seemingly developed beyond their survival needs. In just three centuries, from 1600 to 1900, too short a time for improvement of the human brain by genetic evolution, humankind launched the techno-scientific age. The third enabling precondition is what the physicist Eugene Wigner once called the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in the natural sciences. For reasons that remain elusive to scientists and philosophers alike, the correspondence of mathematical theory and experimental data in physics in particular is uncannily close. It is so close as to compel the belief that mathematics is, in some deep sense, the natural language of science. The enormous usefulness of mathematics in the natural sciences, Wigner wrote, is something bordering on the mysterious. and there is no rational explanation for it. It is not at all natural that laws of nature exist, much less that man is able to discover them. The miracle of the appropriateness of the language of mathematics for the formulation of the laws of physics is a wonderful gift which we neither understand nor deserve. The laws of physics are in fact so accurate as to transcend cultural differences. They boil down to mathematical formulae that cannot be given Chinese or Ethiopian or Mayan nuances, nor do they cut any slack for masculinist or feminist variations. We may even reasonably suppose that any advanced extraterrestrial civilizations, if they possess nuclear power and can launch spacecraft, have discovered the same laws, such that their physics could be translated isomorphically, point to point, set to point, and point to set, into human notation. The greatest exactitude of all has been obtained in measurements of the electron. A single electron is almost unimaginably small. Abstracted into a probabilistic packet of wave energy, it is also nearly impossible to visualize, as is the case generally for phenomena in quantum physics, within the conventional cognitive framework of objects moving in three-dimensional space. Yet we know with confidence that it has a negative charge of 0.16 billion billionth coulomb and a rest mass of 0.91 billion billion billionth gram. From these and other verifiable quantities have been accurately deduced the properties of electric currents, the electromagnetic spectrum, the photoelectric effect, and chemical bonding. The theory that unites such basic phenomena is an interlocking set of graphical representations and equations called quantum electrodynamics, QED. QED treats the position and momentum of each electron as both a wave function and a discrete particle in space. The electron is further envisioned in QED as randomly emitting and reabsorbing photons, the unique massless particles that carry the electromagnetic force. In one property of the electron, its magnetic moment theory and experiment have been matched to the most extreme degree ever achieved in the physical sciences. The magnetic moment is a measure of the interaction between an electron and a magnetic field. More precisely, it is the maximum torque experienced by the electron divided by the magnetic induction acting on it. The quantity of interest is the gyromagnetic ratio, the magnetic moment divided in turn by the angular momentum. Theoretical physicists predicted the value of the gyromagnetic ratio with calculations incorporating both special relativity and perturbations from photon emission and resorption, the two phenomena expected from QED to cause small deviations from the ratio previously predicted by classical atomic physics. For their part, and independently, atomic scientists directly measured the gyromagnetic ratio. In a technical tour de force, they trapped single electrons inside a magnetic electric bottle and studied them for long periods of time. Their data matched the theoretical prediction to one part in 100 billion. Together, the theoretical and experimental physicists accomplished the equivalent of launching a needle due east from San Francisco and correctly calling in advance where it would strike, near Washington, D.C., to within the width of a human hair. The descent to minutissima, the search for ultimate smallness in entities such as electrons, is a driving impulse of Western natural science. It is a kind of instinct. Human beings are obsessed with building blocks, forever pulling them apart and putting them back together again. The impulse goes as far back as 400 BC to the first proto-science, when Leucippus and his student Democritus speculated, correctly, as it turned out, that matter is made of atoms. Reduction to microscopic units has been richly consummated in modern science. The search for the ultimate has been aided through direct visual observation by steady advances in the resolving power of microscopes. This technological enterprise satisfies a second elemental craving, to see all the world with our own eyes. The most powerful of modern instruments, invented during the 1980s, are the scanning tunneling microscope and atomic force microscope, which provide an almost literal view of atoms bonded into molecules. A DNA double helix can now be viewed exactly as it is, including every twist and turn into which a particular molecule fell as the technician prepared it for study. Had such visual techniques existed 50 years ago, the infant science of molecular biology would have escalated even more sharply than it has. In science, as in whist and bridge, one peak is worth 100 finesses. Atomic-level imaging is the end product of 3 centuries of technological innovation in search of the final peak. Microscopy began with the primitive optical instruments of Anton van Leeuwenhoek, which in the late 1600s revealed bacteria and other objects 100 times smaller than the resolution of the human eye. It has arrived at methods for showing objects 1,000,000 times smaller. The passion for dissecting and reassembling has resulted in the invention of nanotechnology, the manufacture of devices composed of a relatively small number of molecules. Among the more impressive recent achievements are etching stainless steel pins with ion beams. Bruce Lamartine and Roger Stutz of the Los Alamos National Laboratory have created high-density ROMs, read-only memories, whose lines are cut so fine, down to 150 billionths of a meter, as to allow the storage of 2 gigabytes of data on a pin 25 millimeters long and 1 millimeter wide. Since the materials are non-magnetic, the information thus stored is nearly indestructible. Yet there is still a long way to go. In theory, at least, atoms can be ordered to store knowledge. A fundamental question in chemistry since the work of Lavoisier in the 18th century has been the following. How long does it take a pair of molecules to meet and bond when different reagents are mixed together? By confining solutions to extremely small spaces, Mark Whiteman and his fellow researchers at the University of North Carolina observed flashes of light that marked the contact of oppositely charged reagent molecules, enabling the chemists to time the reactions with unprecedented accuracy. Molecule-sized machines that assemble themselves under the direction of technicians have for many years been considered a theoretical possibility. Now, the ensembles are being realized in practice. One of the most promising techniques, engineered by George M. Whitesides of Harvard University and other organic chemists, consists in self-assembled monolayers. The SAMs, for short, consist of sausage-shaped molecules such as long hydrocarbon chains called alkanethiols. After synthesis in the laboratory, the substances are painted onto a gold surface. One end of each molecule has properties that cause it to adhere to the gold. The other end, built of atoms with different properties, projects outward into space. Thus, lined up like soldiers on parade, molecules of the same kind create a single layer only 1 to 2 nanometers thick. Molecules of a different construction are next laid down to create a second layer on top of the first, and so on, compound by compound, to produce a stratified film of desired thickness and chemical properties. SAMs share some of the basic properties of membranes of living cells. Their construction suggests one possible step in the eventual assembly of simple artificial organisms. Although far from being alive, SAMs are simulacra of elemental pieces of life. Given enough such components assembled the right way, chemists may someday produce a passable living cell. The intellectual thrust of modern science and its significance for the consilient worldview can be summarized as follows. In the ultimate sense, our brain and sensory system evolved as a biological apparatus to preserve and multiply human genes. But they enable us to navigate only through the tiny segment of the physical world whose mastery serves that primal need. Instrumental science has removed the handicap. Still, science in its fullness is much more than just the haphazard expansion of sensory capacity by instruments. The other elements in its creative mix are classification of data and their interpretation by theory. Together, they compose the rational processing of sensory experience enhanced by instrumentation. Nothing in science, nothing in life, for that matter, makes sense without theory. It is our nature to put all knowledge into context in order to tell a story and to recreate the world by this means. So let us visit the topic of theory for a moment. We are enchanted by the beauty of the natural world. Our eye is caught by the dazzling visual patterns of polar star trails, for example, and the choreography of chromosomes and dividing root tip cells of a plant. Both disclose processes that are also vital to our lives. In unprocessed form, however, without the theoretical frameworks of heliocentric astronomy and Mendelian heredity, they are no more than beautiful patterns of light. Theory, a word hobbled by multiple meanings, taken alone without a or the, it resonates with erudition. Taken in everyday context, it is shot through with corrupting ambiguity. We often hear that such and such an assertion is only a theory. Anyone can have a theory. Pay your money and take your choice among the theories that compete for your attention. Voodoo priests sacrificing chickens to please spirits of the dead are working with the theory. So are millenarian cultists watching the Idaho skies for signs of the second coming. Because scientific theories contain speculation, they too may seem just more guesswork, and therefore built on sand. That, I suspect, is the usual postmodernist conception. Everyone's theory has validity and is interesting. Scientific theories, however, are fundamentally different. They are constructed specifically to be blown apart if proved wrong, and if so destined, the sooner the better. Make your mistakes quickly is a rule in the practice of science. I grant that scientists often fall in love with their own constructions. I know. I have. They may spend a lifetime vainly trying to shore them up. A few squander their prestige and academic political capital in the effort. In that case, as the economist Paul Samuelson once quipped, funeral by funeral, theory advances. Quantum electrodynamics and evolution by natural selection are examples of successful big theories addressing important phenomena. The entities they posit, such as photons, electrons, and genes, can be measured. Their statements are designed to be tested in the acid washes of skepticism, experiments, and the claims of rival theories. Without this vulnerability, they will not be accorded the status of scientific theories. The best theories are rendered lean by Occam's razor, first expressed in the 1320s by William of Ockham. He said, "What can be done with fewer assumptions is done in vain with more." Parsimony is a criterion of good theory. With lean, tested theory, we no longer need Phoebus in a chariot to guide the sun across the sky, or dryads to populate the boreal forests. The practice grants less license for New Age dreaming, I admit, but it gets the world straight. Still, scientific theories are a product of imagination, informed imagination. They reach beyond their grasp to predict the existence of previously unsuspected phenomena. They generate hypotheses, disciplined guesses about unexplored topics whose parameters the theories help to define. The best theories generate the most fruitful hypotheses, which translate cleanly into questions that can be answered by observation and experiment. Theories and their progeny, hypotheses, compete for the available data, which comprise the limiting resource in the ecology of scientific knowledge. The survivors in this tumultuous environment are the Darwinian victors, welcomed into the canon, settling in our minds, guiding us to further exploration of physical reality, more surprises, and yes, more poetry. Science, to put its warrant as concisely as possible, is the organized, systematic enterprise that gathers knowledge about the world and condenses the knowledge into testable laws and principles. The diagnostic features of science that distinguish it from pseudoscience are first, repeatability. The same phenomenon is sought again, preferably by independent investigation, and the interpretation given to it is confirmed or discarded by means of novel analysis and experimentation. Second, economy. Scientists attempt to abstract the information into the form that is both simplest and aesthetically most pleasing, the combination called elegance, while yielding the largest amount of information with the least amount of effort. Third, mensuration. If something can be properly measured using universally accepted scales, generalizations about it are rendered unambiguous. Fourth, heuristics. The best science stimulates further discovery, often in unpredictable new directions, and the new knowledge provides an additional test of the original principles that led to its discovery. Fifth and finally, consilience. The explanations of different phenomena most likely to survive are those that can be connected and proved consistent with one another. Astronomy, biomedicine, and physiological psychology possess all these criteria. Astrology, ufology, creation science, and Christian science, sadly, possess none. And it should not go unnoticed that the true natural sciences lock together in theory and evidence to form the ineradicable technical base of modern civilization. The pseudosciences satisfy personal psychological needs, for reasons I will explain later, but lack the ideas or the means to contribute to the technical base. The cutting edge of science is reductionism, the breaking apart of nature into its natural constituents. The very word, it is true, has a sterile and invasive ring, like scalpel or catheter. Critics of science sometimes portray reductionism as an obsessional disorder, declining toward a terminal stage, one writer recently dubbed reductive megalomania. That characterization is an actionable misdiagnosis. Practicing scientists, whose business is to make verifiable discoveries, view reductionism in an entirely different way. It is the search strategy employed to find points of entry into otherwise impenetrably complex systems. Complexity is what interests scientists in the end, not simplicity. Reductionism is the way to understand it. The love of complexity without reductionism makes art. The love of complexity with reductionism makes science. Here is how reductionism works most of the time, as it might appear in a user's manual. Let your mind travel around the system. Pose an interesting question about it. Break the question down and visualize the elements and questions it implies. Think out alternative, conceivable answers. Phrase them so that a reasonable amount of evidence makes a clear-cut choice possible. If too many conceptual difficulties are encountered, back off. Search for another question. When you finally hit a soft spot, search for the model system. Say, a controlled emission in particle physics, or a fast-breeding organism in genetics, on which decisive experiments can be most easily conducted. Become thoroughly familiar, no, better, become obsessed with the system. Love the details, the feel of all of them, for their own sake. Design the experiment so that no matter what the result, the answer to the question will be convincing. Use the result to press on to new questions, new systems. Depending on how far others have already gone in this sequence, and always keep in mind you must give them complete credit, you may enter it at any point along the way. Followed more or less along these lines, reductionism is the primary and essential activity of science. But dissection and analysis are not all that scientists do. Also crucial are synthesis and integration, tempered by philosophical reflection on significance and value. Even the most narrowly focused researchers, including those devoted to the search for elemental units, still think all the time about complexity. To make any progress, they must meditate on the networks of cause and effect across adjacent levels of organization. From subatomic particles to atoms, say, or organisms to species. And they must think on the hidden design and forces of the networks of causation. Quantum physics thus blends into chemical physics, which explains atomic bonding and chemical reactions, which form the foundation of molecular biology, which demystifies cell biology. Behind the mere smashing of aggregates into smaller pieces lies a deeper agenda that also takes the name of reductionism. To fold the laws and principles of each level of organization into those at more general, hence more fundamental levels. Its strong form is total consilience, which holds that nature is organized by simple, universal laws of physics to which all other laws and principles can eventually be reduced. This transcendental worldview is the light and way for many scientific materialists. I admit to being among them. But it could be wrong. At the least, it is surely an oversimplification. At each level of organization, especially at the living cell and above, phenomena exist that require new laws and principles which still cannot be predicted from those at more general levels. Perhaps some of them will remain forever beyond our grasp. Perhaps prediction of the most complex systems from more general levels is impossible. That would not be all bad. I will confess with pleasure, the challenge and the crackling of thin ice are what give science its metaphysical excitement. Science, its imperfections notwithstanding, is the sword in the stone that humanity finally pulled. The question it poses of universal and orderly materialism is the most important that can be asked in philosophy and religion. Its procedures are not easy to master, even to conceptualize. That is why it took so long to get started, and then, mostly in one place, which happened to be Western Europe. The work is also hard, and for long intervals, frustrating. You have to be a bit compulsive to be a productive scientist. Keep in mind that new ideas are commonplace, and almost always wrong. Most flashes of insight lead nowhere. Statistically, they have a half-life of hours, or maybe days. Most experiments to follow up the surviving insights are tedious and consume large amounts of time, only to yield negative, or worse, ambiguous results. Over the years, I have been presumptuous enough to counsel new PhDs in biology as follows. If you choose an academic career, you will need 40 hours a week to perform teaching and administrative duties, another 20 hours on top of that to conduct respectable research, and still another 20 hours to accomplish really important research. This formula is not boot camp rhetoric. More than half the PhDs in science are stillborn, dropping out of original research after at most one or two publications. Percy Bridgman, the founder of high-pressure physics, no pun intended, put the guideline another way. The scientific method is doing your damnedest, no holds barred. Original discovery is everything. Scientists, as a rule, do not discover in order to know, but rather, as the philosopher Alfred North Whitehead observed, they know in order to discover. They learn what they need to know, often remaining poorly informed about the rest of the world, including most of science, for that matter, in order to move speedily to some part of the frontier of science where discoveries are made. There, they spread out like foragers on a picket line, each alone or in small groups, probing a carefully chosen, narrow sector. When two scientists meet for the first time, the usual conversation entry is, "What do you work on?" They already know what generally bonds them. They are fellow prospectors, pressing deeper into an abstracted world, content most of the time to pick up an occasional nugget, but dreaming of the mother lode. They come to work each day thinking subconsciously, "It's there. I'm close. This could be the day." They know the first rule of the professional game book. Make an important discovery, and you are a successful scientist in the true elitist sense, in a profession where elitism is practiced without shame. You go into the textbooks. Nothing can take that away. You may rest on your laurels for the rest of your life. But of course, you won't. Almost no one driven enough to make an important discovery ever rests. And any discovery at all is thrilling. There is no feeling more pleasant, no drug more addictive than setting foot on virgin soil. Fail to discover, and you are little or nothing in the culture of science, no matter how much you learn and write about science. Scholars in the humanities also make discoveries, of course, but their most original and valuable scholarship is usually the interpretation and explanation of already existing knowledge. When a scientist begins to sort out knowledge in order to sift for meaning, and especially when he carries that knowledge outside the circle of discoverers, he is classified as a scholar in the humanities. Without scientific discoveries of his own, he may be a veritable archangel among intellectuals, his broad wings spread above science, and still not be in the circle. The true and final test of a scientific career is how well the following declarative sentence can be completed. He or she discovered that. A fundamental distinction thus exists in the natural sciences between process and product. The difference explains why so many accomplished scientists are narrow, foolish people, and why so many wise scholars in the field are considered weak scientists. Yet oddly, there is very little science culture, at least in the strict tribal sense. Few rites are performed to speak of. There is at most only a scattering of icons. One does, however, hear a great deal of bickering over territory and status. The social organization of science most resembles a loose confederation of petty fiefdoms. In religious belief, individual scientists vary from born-again Christians, admittedly rare, to hardcore atheists, very common. Few are philosophers. Most are intellectual journeymen, exploring locally, hoping for a strike, living for the present. They are content to work at discovery, often teaching science at the college level, pleased to be relatively well-paid members of one of the more contentious, but overall least conspiratorial, of professions. In character, they are as variable as the population at large. Take any random sample of 1,000, and you will find the near full human range on every axis of measurement, generous to predatory, well-adjusted to psychopathic, casual to driven, grave to frivolous, gregarious to reclusive. Some are as stolid as tax accountants in April, while a few are clinically certifiable as manic depressives, or bipolars, to use the ambiguous new term. In motivation, they run from venal to noble. Einstein classified scientists very well during the celebration of Max Planck's 60th birthday in 1918. In the Temple of Science, he said, are three kinds of people. Many take to science out of a joyful sense of their superior intellectual power. For them, research is a kind of sport that satisfies personal ambition. A second class of researchers engages in science to achieve purely utilitarian ends. But of the third, if the angel of the Lord were to come and drive all the people belonging to these two categories out of the temple, a few people would be left, including Planck, and that is why we love him. Scientific research is an art form in this sense. It does not matter how you make a discovery, only that your claim is true and convincingly validated. The ideal scientist thinks like a poet and works like a bookkeeper, and I suppose that if gifted with a full quiver, he also writes like a journalist. As a painter stands before bare canvas, or a novelist recycles past emotion with eyes closed, he searches his imagination for subjects as much as for conclusions, for questions as much as for answers. Even if his highest achievement is only to perceive the need for a new instrument or theory, that may be enough to open the door to a new industry of research. This level of creativity in science, as in art, depends as much on self-image as on talent. To be highly successful, the scientist must be confident enough to steer for blue water, abandoning sight of land for a while. He values risk for its own sake. He keeps in mind that the footnotes of forgotten treatises are strewn with the names of the gifted, but timid. If, on the other hand, he chooses, like the vast majority of his colleagues, to hug the coast, he must be fortunate enough to possess what I like to define as optimum intelligence for normal science, bright enough to see what needs to be done, but not so bright as to suffer boredom doing it. The scientist's style of investigation is the product of the discipline he chooses, further narrowed by aptitude and taste. If a naturalist at heart, he saunters at random, sometimes through real woods thick with trees, or more commonly nowadays, cells thick with molecules, in search of objects and happenings still unimagined. His instinct is that of the hunter. If, on the other hand, the scientist is a mathematical theorist, he creates a mental picture of a known but still poorly understood process, skeletonizes it into what intuition suggests are its essential elements, and recasts it in diagrams and equations. He looks for vindication by saying to the experimentalists, if this is the way the process works, even if we cannot see it directly, then here are the parameters for an indirect probe and the language by which we might come to explain the results. Differences in validation criteria across the disciplines are accordingly vast. Systematic biologists need only stumble upon an unusual new species and recognize its novelty to make an important discovery. In 1995, two Danish zoologists erected an entirely new phylum of animals, the 35th known, from a species of tiny rotifer-like creatures found living on the mouthparts of lobsters. In a wholly different domain and style, biochemists regularly trace the natural syntheses of hormones and other biologically important molecules by duplicating the steps with enzymatically mediated reactions in the laboratory. Experimental physicists, even further removed than chemists from direct perception, and hence the most esoteric among the scientific multitude, deduce, to take a properly esoteric example, the spatial distribution of quarks from high-energy collisions of electrons with protons of atomic nuclei. Advice to the novice scientist. There is no fixed way to make and establish a scientific discovery. Throw everything you can at the subject as long as the procedures can be duplicated by others. Consider repeated observations of a physical event under varying circumstances. Experiments in different modes and styles. Correlation of supposed causes and effects. Statistical analyses to reject null hypotheses, those deliberately raised to threaten the conclusion, logical argument, and attention to detail and consistency with the results published by others. All these actions, singly and in combination, are part of the tested and true armamentarium of science. As the work comes together, also think about the audience to whom it will be reported. Plan to publish in a reputable peer-reviewed journal. One of the strictures of the scientific ethos is that a discovery does not exist until it is safely reviewed and in print. Scientific evidence is accretionary, built from blocks of evidence joined artfully by the blueprints and mortar of theory. Only very rarely, as in the theories of natural selection and relativity, does an idea change our conception of the world in one quantum leap. Even the revolution of molecular biology was accretionary, building upon, but not fundamentally altering, physics and chemistry. Few claims in science, and particularly those entailing concepts, are accepted as final. But as evidence piles upon evidence and theories interlock more firmly, certain bodies of knowledge do gain universal acceptance. In seminar patois, they ascend a scale of credibility from interesting to suggestive to persuasive and finally compelling, and given enough time thereafter, obvious. No objective yardstick exists on which to mark these degrees of acceptance. There is no body of external objective truth by which they can be calibrated. There is only warranted assertability, to use William James' phrase, within which particular descriptions of reality grow ever more congenial to scientists until objections cease. A proof, as the mathematician Mark Katz once put it, is that which convinces a reasonable man. A rigorous proof is that which convinces an unreasonable man. It is occasionally possible to encapsulate a method of science as a recipe. The most satisfying is that based on multiple competing hypotheses, also known as strong inference. It works only on relatively simple processes under restricted circumstances, and particularly in physics and chemistry, where context and history are unlikely to affect the outcome. The phenomenon under scrutiny is known to occur, but cannot be seen directly, with the result that its exact nature can only be guessed. Investigators think out every possible way the process might occur, the multiple competing hypotheses, and devise tests that will eliminate all but one. In a celebrated 1958 example, Matthew Meselson and Franklin Stahl, then at the California Institute of Technology, used the method to demonstrate the steps by which DNA molecules duplicate themselves. I will first give their conclusion. The double helix splits lengthwise to create two single helices. Each single helix then assembles a new partner to create another double helix. Alternative hypotheses that the double helix duplicates itself in its entirety, or that the single helices are broken and dispersed by the duplication process, must be discarded. Now the proof, which despite its technical content, is elegantly simple. Having phrased what in retrospect turns out to have been the right question, Meselson and Stahl devised the right experiment to make a choice among the competing alternatives. They first let bacteria that had manufactured DNA molecules in a heavy nitrogen medium continue their multiplication in a normal nitrogen medium. The researchers then extracted the molecules and centrifuged them in a cesium chloride solution that formed a gradient of density. DNA molecules built by the bacteria with heavy nitrogen settled deeper into the cesium chloride density gradient than did otherwise identical DNA molecules built by the same bacteria with normal nitrogen. When equilibrium was reached, the DNA had separated out into sharply defined bands in a pattern that exactly fit the hypothesis of single helix separation and double helix regeneration. The pattern eliminated the two competing hypotheses of whole molecule duplication and fragmentation followed by dispersion of the fragments. Science, even in the relatively tidy world of molecular genetics, is a patchwork of such arguments and proofs. But perhaps there are common elements in its methods. Can we devise a universal litmus test for scientific statements and with it eventually attain the grail of objective truth? Current opinion holds that we cannot and never will. Scientists and philosophers have largely abandoned the search for absolute objectivity and are content to ply their trade elsewhere. I think otherwise, and will risk heresy. The answer could well be yes. Criteria of objective truth might be attainable through empirical investigation. The key lies in clarifying the still poorly understood operations composing the mind and in improving the piecemeal approach science has taken to its material properties. Here is the argument. Outside our heads, there is freestanding reality. Only madmen and a scattering of constructivist philosophers doubt its existence. Inside our heads is a reconstitution of reality based on sensory input and the self-assembly of concepts. Input and self-assembly, rather than an independent entity in the brain, the ghost in the machine, in the philosopher Gilbert Ryle's famous derogation, constitute the mind. The alignment of outer existence with its inner representation has been distorted by the idiosyncrasies of human evolution, as I noted earlier. That is, natural selection built the brain to survive in the world and only incidentally to understand it at a depth greater than is needed to survive. The proper task of scientists is to diagnose and correct the misalignment. The effort to do so has only begun. No one should suppose that objective truth is impossible to attain, even when the most committed philosophers urge us to acknowledge that incapacity. In particular, it is too early for scientists, the foot soldiers of epistemology, to yield ground so vital to their mission. Although seemingly chimerical at times, no intellectual vision is more important and daunting than that of objective truth based on scientific understanding. Or more venerable. Argued at length in Greek philosophy, it took modern form in the 18th century Enlightenment hope that science would find the laws governing all physical existence. Thus empowered, the savants believed, we could clear away the debris of millennia, including all the myths and false cosmologies that encumber humanity's self-image. The Enlightenment dream faded before the allure of Romanticism, but even more important, science could not deliver in the domain most crucial to its promise, the physical basis of mind. The two failings worked together in a devastating combination. People are innate romantics. They desperately need myth and dogma. And scientists could not explain why people have this need. As the 19th century closed, the dream of objective truth was rekindled by two philosophies. The first, European in origin, was positivism, the conviction that only certain knowledge is the exact description of what we perceive with our senses. The second, American in origin, was pragmatism, the belief that truth is what consistently works in human action. From the outset, both positions were symbiotic with science. They drew major strength from the spectacular advances in the physical sciences then underway, which vindicated them by the varied actions, electromagnetic motors, X-rays, reagent chemistry, that exact practical knowledge made possible. The dream of objective truth peaked soon afterward with the formulation of logical positivism, a variation on general positivism that attempted to define the essence of scientific statements by means of logic and the analysis of language. Although many thinkers contributed to the movement, its driving force was the Vienna Circle, a group of mostly Austrian intellectuals founded by the philosopher Moritz Schlick in 1924. Regular meetings of the circle continued until Schlick's death in 1936 and the subsequent dispersion of its members and correspondents, some of whom emigrated to America as exiles from the Nazi regime. On September 3rd through the 9th, 1939, many of the scholars sympathetic to logical positivism met at Harvard University to attend the 5th International Congress for the Unity of Science. It was a scintillating assemblage of names now enshrined in the history of ideas. Rudolf Carnap, Philip Frank, Suzanne Langer, Richard von Mises, Ernest Nagel, Otto Neurath, Talcott Parsons, Willard Van Quine, and George Sarton. The conferees must have been badly distracted by the invasion of Poland, which began 2 days before the meeting started. where the Napoleonic campaigns weakened the plausibility of the original Enlightenment, now a savage war of territorial conquest fired by a pseudo-scientific theory of racial superiority threatened to make a still greater mockery of the power of reason. The scholars persisted, however, in exploring the idea that rationally acquired knowledge is the best hope of humanity. How then, they asked, to distill the scientific ethos? The movement created by the Vienna Circle had worked at two levels over the years. First was the reaffirmation of the core Enlightenment ideal that the cause of the human species is best served